Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Welcome to DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon, the unique blend of hunting, conservation, and the outdoor lifestyle, delivered in an entertaining, informative fashion that only a veteran outdoorsman can do. DSC Campfires is brought to you by DSC, Conservation, Education, and Hunter Advocacy. Hornady, accurate, deadly, dependable. Trigicon, brilliant aiming solutions. Ruger, rugged, reliable firearms. Burnham Brothers Game Calls, callingest calls made. Double Nickel Taxidermy, where hunting memories are preserved. Taurus, maker of the Raging Hunter and other fine handguns. Now here's your host, Larry Wysoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our next installment of DSC's Campfires. And, you know, our campfires takes us to a lot of different places, and it just happens to be an evening at the end of a pronghorn antelope hunt on Mr. John Eason's place over in Socorro County, New Mexico. We had a gentleman that hunted with us today, Mr. Doug Deutschman, who is with the Hatata Ranch. This particular hunt was sold at the DSC Foundation Gala in July of 2021, and Trevor Allberg bought the hunt. And as it works out, Mr. Doug works for Trevor, and he kindly gave him the opportunity to come out here and to hunt the pronghorn antelope there in New Mexico. And I was sitting around the campfire tonight. Doug had to leave this morning, but we've got Mr. John Eason, who is the owner here on the ranch and also an owner farther south. You may remember Mr. John from in the past when we had a mule deer hunt that we talked about a little bit with Luke Clayton and Jeff Rice back during the January-February time. And then got Mr. Jeremiah Bennett with us as well, too. Jeremiah is an absolutely fabulous cameraman, artist, all those other kind of good things. And the show that we were here for was to film for Trigicon's World of Sports Field. That's done by Safari Classics. So, gentlemen, it's good to be back with y'all here. And we had kind of an interesting hunt today, didn't we?
It was a trip. Started out kind of rough. The wind wasn't playing very fair. 12, 15 mile an hour crosswinds, and antelope were in a pocket that was hard to get to, and ended up having to take a 465 yard shot that I like to get closer, but
We weren't getting any closer.
No, they were in no man's land.
They really were. They're out in the middle of absolute nowhere. Where there
three of us?
out there.
I was off in the background watching you guys, yeah. And where those antelope were, we had a little old bull snake that we found here close to the house digging a hole, and he was about to, or she was about the right height to crawl through some of that stuff, and even there were some places there I think she might have had a little bit of a problem not being seen.
A single hunter is one thing, two is another, and three is just tough on antelope, you know.
It really is. This particular ranch is a fair size ranch and a lot of acres, and I started out about 3 days ago, and when we got here, and it was a 3 day hunt. The thing about New Mexico is you can choose 3 days to hunt on your license through a given set of dates, like from maybe October the 1st through the 30th. Don't quote me on those because I'm not real sure on the dates, but you can select 3 days that you can hunt consecutively, and that's your hunt. As it worked out, we were here kind of was a 7th, 8th, 9th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, somewhere along and through there. I can't remember the exact dates right now.
I don't keep up with what
7th, 8th, 9th.
Yeah. The hunt date started on the 7th.
So 7, 8, and 7, 8, 9. And,
yeah.
And Doug had never previously hunted antelope, which was really kind of fun in the fact of having somebody with us that had never hunted antelope, and it's an experience. They've got some absolutely fantastic eyesight, and they know the land, we had a fair number the first day that we got onto, and of course Doug decided to pass on the buck that he,
right.
Eventually we continue to hunt for.
Have I ever told you how much I love antelope hunting, by the way?
Not on the podcast, but I recall sometime during the last 3 days numerous references to hunting pronghorn antelope, particularly on camera.
Yeah, they can be so frustratingly hard and difficult, you know. They just really can.
It's just extremely hard to get up on them. I mean, they've got virtually almost 360-degree eyesight that's unreal. An eagle has nothing on them as far as seeing things. And if you can get within 200 yards, you've done something, really, especially out in this country where it's so wide open.
You're exactly right. Again, there are places that I've hunted antelope where you had little draws that you could get around in, or maybe use, you know, clumps of tall grass or something like that, or choy. And there's some of that here, but where these antelope were that y'all were hunting the last 3 days, there wasn't a whole lot of cover out there, much bigger than what that little bull snake could crawl through.
No. If it hadn't been for the decoys, getting in behind the decoys and slipping in, and
Mr. John, tell us a little bit about the decoys. You carry two decoys when we've been hunting.
I've got two. I've got Bessie McCow decoy. I call her Bessie. She's been very productive over the years. And Annie the Antelope that I use in conjunction with each other. I'll walk in a ways with one, then I'll pop up the antelope umbrella and get their attention with it. It piques their interest, and a lot of times it works, sometimes it don't. This one particular bunch, it worked great the first day when we got on. We got in within 189 yards and decided not to take him, see if we could maybe do a little bit better. Then the next day we just tried to get back on him again, and I think, we were 300 yards.
Yeah.
360 just over, yards, something like that. And then they had a couple old does that busted us and took off running, and everybody else decided to follow
her.
Yeah, I think it was the total of the six legs. I think maybe antelope can count, by golly. You know, you talk to people who've done research on them, and they tell you that basically the antelope has got the same eyesight that we do, aided by an 8-power binocular. And you think about that, and they're very quick about picking up movement or anything that's strange, because they seem to know that habitat so well that if there's the slightest change here, they pick up on it, and the next thing you know, you see that hair kind of flare up and pay out, and they're gone, kind of thing.
I tell all my hunters, I said, you know, one thing about it, when you see that antelope, you can bet one of them's done seen you. They're pretty much 100% of the time.
Yes, sir. Their eyesight, as you mentioned, they can essentially see almost 360 degrees, and their eyesight is so fantastic that they do have ears, they do have a nose, but they don't really pay a whole lot of attention comparatively to what they see.
Right.
The antelope, too, is a true success story. You go back not that terribly long ago, back in the late 1800s, and a lot of antelope had no longer there. I mean, one time the antelope pretty much ranged all over the plains states and up into Canada and down into Mexico, and through various, very different problems that included, habitat destruction, they got down to a very small number, and it was at that point some of the landowners and a few hunters basically got together and said, we got to do something about this, and they brought the antelope back, and it is one of those truly great success stories when it comes to wildlife conservation, including here in New Mexico.
We generally have a lot of antelope around this area, Socorro County being the number one in the state for Boone and Crockett antelope.
Yes, sir.
And this year has been extremely dry, and they're here, but they're just not in the numbers. They've moved up into the areas where there was more rain.
Yes, sir.
Antelope travel a tremendous amount of territory.
They really do, and that's what people don't realize sometimes, is that you mentioned the rain. They can see, they can smell that rain, and when it rains in a certain area, so very often that's where they go to, knowing that, fresh grass and weeds are going to be coming up there. This ranch, too, has been, it's well-watered, which one of the things that I noticed that y'all rotate your cattle on as well,
rotate
too.
Cattle.
But even in those pastures where you've already rotated cattle out of, you still got water there.
Still got water. We keep watering all of our pastures all the time, and like I say, we rotate the cattle. And one thing we don't do here is we don't run any more cattle in the best of times than what we can run in the worst of times. Therefore, we don't have to feed a lot. Virtually nothing. A lot of the ranchers run into problems. They run out of grass, they get too many cattle, and then it gets dry, and then there's no grass, or it's a bad winter, and there's no grass, and they got to feed. Well, all your profit's down the drain that way. So we don't do that.
Well, I noticed the cows that we looked at, they look like they've been in the feedlot.
Oh, they look good.
I'm talking about cows with calves at their side, this kind of thing, too.
Most of those cows got a 500-600-pound calf on their side right now, and they're just
butterball fat.
Roll a dozen eggs down their back without losing one.
Well, having Doug in camp, I'm sorry that he's not here tonight to tell us, his version of the story of how everything came together. But that's one of the great things that happened here. John, thank you and your family so very much for donating the hunt, which was donated to the DSC Foundation Gala, which we sold. And I think it brought like in excess of $10,000-$12,000, something like that, for the opportunity to come out here and hunt. And all that money that essentially will go to other conservation projects. I mean, through the DSC Foundation, we get a lot of grant requests from different organizations, including like the Mule Deer Foundation and Texas Wildlife Association. Another organization do a lot of work in terms of making sure that we have some education in terms of what animals are required, what they require, and then actually doing the work. But also in terms of youth and adult hunting kind of programs that are going on. But we also do a lot of stuff elsewhere. But again, as Tim Fallon, our president, has often said, the president of the DSC Foundation, is our job is to raise money so we can give away more money so we can raise more money kind of thing. Because all these projects that we do are extremely vetted. I mean, they come in and they make a request for a certain amount of dollars, and we go through them like a fine-tooth comb to decide which ones we actually will provide money to. And then they have to report to us how that money is used, too. Otherwise, chances are if they don't, they ain't going to get any more in the future kind of thing. So guys like you, particularly with the donations of the hunts, are so very important in terms of raising the money so that we can do some really good work. And I mentioned the Mule Deer Foundation. I think we issued maybe three or four grants this year to the Mule Deer Foundation of very worthwhile projects that they're done in terms of, because mule deer is kind of, I know you like mule deer because I've been down there in your place, and in western Texas, and you know, they've kind of taken it on the chin a little bit in different ways. So there's so many things going on with the Mule Deer Foundation that we feel like we can support in their efforts.
Yeah, we manage our mule deer down there and the whitetail herds pretty hard. We probably don't take near as many deer as we could, but manage them hard. The last few years have been rough on the mule deer for some reason, and I haven't let any of the hunters take any does at all.
Right, yes, sir.
Just because I want to keep the numbers going. And
yes, sir. Like you mentioned that years ago, we've been here in Texas, we tried to manage mule deer like we did whitetail, and we found out very quickly that your reproductive rates in most whitetail does, and they're on a good nutritional diet. Doe fawn, 80% or more will breed as 6-month-old doe fawn. Most mule deer does do not breed until they're at least 2.5 years of age. And so if you start putting a whole lot of pressure on mule deer does, you can knock that population down to nothing in a relatively short period of time.
And we, you know, here at the ranch here in New Mexico, we manage it pretty hard too. We could get more tags and stuff for the property, but I just don't take just a limited number every year.
Yes, sir.
I just don't do it any other way.
Well, to me, doing it that way, you're always going to have mature animals in the herd. And, you know, you hear a lot of people talk about, to me, big horns, whether on a mule deer or big antlers on a whitetail or a mule deer or an elk, those antlers and horns are a reflection of the health of that population. And so when you start producing a fair number of big mature bucks, particularly once they start getting some age on, that just tells me that somebody's doing things right in terms of making sure there's plenty for them to eat. And what you mentioned earlier is that you keep your cow level at what it can support this here range here at the worst of times, not right. The best of times.
Right.
And that's really kind of the way to do some of the population, particularly with whitetail as well, where you have these high peaks and lows of rainfall or lack of rainfall.
Well, and you know, down at the ranch there in Texas with the deer, the same as here, we've got good water scattered all over the ranch, and we feed them. We feed a lot of protein, up to about 45 tons of protein feed a year, just the deer alone.
Wow.
And plus corn, they'll get close to that same amount of corn every year.
Yes, sir.
And we manage it pretty hard. We try to do, and if you remember, it's been back 9-10 years ago when I first met you at a Mule Deer Foundation banquet.
Yes, sir.
Got you cornered up and was trying to pick your brain, and you were gracious enough to answer my questions that I had, being, you know, fairly new to management programs like that, and see what I needed to do to try to make everything better. And that's how our friendship began. And
you started telling me what you were doing and the results that you had. With what you were doing, and what did I tell you to do?
You told me don't change a thing.
That's exactly what I thought then, and now, you know, having been to the ranch a couple times, I feel exactly the same way. I mean, what you've done on that property, and the property we're on right here is flat, rolling pinyon junipers.
Choya,
lots of choya, but also
a lot of grama grass.
So you've got a pretty darn good variant, and it's absolutely beautiful ranch.
And you don't see grama grass much taller than what it is running around here right now. Some of us knee deep,
right? And particularly not with cattle on it,
I mean. But we've got our fallow pastures that nothing's on right now, and grass is knee deep in there. And this high desert country is. If you look at a lot of the ranches around us, they're not like that.
There's like a fence line fault, because you can look down the fence line, and on one side, things look really good, and on the other side,
not so good.
Not so good.
It's management. I mean, you know, that's the way my brother and I, at our parents, a couple years now, turned everything over to us, and of course, we've been doing it for a long time.
Oh, yes, you're right.
And my brother and I continue to do it, and not going to change it right now.
No.
I mean, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
it ain't broke. It ain't broke. Jeremiah, you film a lot. You film with so many different people all over the world. Now, you alluded to the fact about how much you love hunting pronghorn antelope with a camera and a hunter. And you were a little bit. What are you talking about there?
Well, I've done a fair number of filmed antelope hunts, and they've always been rifle hunts and spot right. and stalk, and man, they're just so wary. They're so wary, and they're it's frustrating, you know, because for television, you really do like to have that footage that's say 200 yards and in.
Right. You know? Or 200 yards or closer.
But
right.
so many times it all goes to pot at 400 plus yards, you know. I mean, you can get within, like, you know, today, this morning, we were 465 yards, and there was no way we were getting closer.
No.
No way. And so, you know, you're filming for television, and these things look like fleas on the viewfinder, you know, but it's all you got.
Right.
It's all you got. What do you do? So you do the best you can with the situation that you got. And
well, it got you the 189 one time. I mean,
well, hey,
John, you got the number one guide in Clonce, New Mexico,
John.
I may be the only one, but you know what can I say,
John? I know, and that's could be very likely the same buck that we took this morning.
I'm convinced it was.
We had him at 189 yards, right?
Right,
189, but. You know, I mean, we caught back up with him again, and
we started a mile away.
Yeah, I know.
And walked into 189 yards.
I decided to hang back because there was no need for four people to go. You know, we had Doug, had you, Mr. John, and you. You know, to film it, there wasn't any reason to have a fourth person there to complicate matters.
Less is more. Less is always more.
Jeremy, I think the whole thing was. That was that mile from where we were sitting, looking at them, to down there where they were at, that he didn't want to walk.
Me?
No, him.
Oh.
That's why he stayed and kept the buggy tied down where it didn't blow away off top of
the hill. Somebody had to protect the buggy bug. Hold down the fort. You know, just in case.
Had to hold down the fort. Well, he'd have had to hold it down to the ground today. Oh. Today, because the wind is howling.
Thank goodness we got it done this morning.
I totally agree.
This afternoon.
But I'll tell you, where I was going with that, it was absolutely fantastic to watch y'all do that stock and to play with you playing with alternating with the cow and the antelope, because in looking through the spotting scope that I look, there are times I thought y'all were 25 yards away from him. I thought the animal, but it was just that perspective of, you know, from where I was.
The compression.
Magnification and the compression thereof. But, I mean, y'all, that buck came running to y'all for a little bit. So
yeah, he saw that decoy.
Yes.
And here he came. Yeah. He was coming.
I mean, it looked like y'all had him on a string there for a little bit. And I was really surprised when Doug didn't shoot, because it is a really nice antelope. But again, with all due respect, you know, Doug has not had the opportunity to hunt pronghorn before.
Yeah.
And after this trip, you know, good Lord willing, he'll go on another pronghorn hunt. I think he'll look at pronghorn a little bit differently maybe than what he did coming into this thing.
Well, I've done a lot of spot and stalk hunting, filming. You know, in all over the United States and other countries too, and it seems that there's always you've got enough cover you can work around.
Yeah,
but it just never seems to work that way with antelope, and that's why I just love antelope hunting so much. I love it.
Hey, did I tell you we were going to do the whole series of nothing but pronghorn hunting next year?
Oh, God.
No, I don't see that happening, quite frankly, because it is so very tough to get footage. I mean, if you're going to bow hunt and you're going to sit in a
tent line on a water hole or something, that's one thing.
And that's one way to hunt them as well, too. Mm-hmm. But to me, the fun actually comes in, and the frustration as well, too, obviously.
I'll tell you what, this ranch here had so much water that it's that that would have been a
yeah
a tough. I mean, that would have been a tough decision to make to sit.
Exactly.
Water, because they just they had water any direction they wanted to
go. Yeah, and here with the New Mexico system, you can pick 3 days to hunt.
And that's it.
And the 3 days that you'd sit on a water hole, they may be going to the one half a mile away or a mile away right. or 2 miles away yeah, kind right. of thing. And so to do it that way, we did it the best way that we could as far as I'm concerned.
And of course, we had some rain last night, so there's some of these dirt tanks that have a little bit of water
just,
in them,
just a little,
and it don't take much.
No, I mean, I've watched like deer and mule, white-tailed mule deer and even pronghorn antelope drink out of a cow tract with water in it a whole lot better and more often than they would in a freestanding water trough over the site, although they will go there. But see, like if there's the slightest little mud hole, that's where they hit first.
Well, there where I live in Texas, I feed the deer out my front yard every afternoon, and I'll have anywhere from 30 to 50 deer in my yard every afternoon, and I've got 3 water tubs out there that I keep full for.
Oh, yes, sir.
But we get a rain, there's a little dirt tank over at the corner of my yard over there, and yes, they'll sir. Drink out of that before they'll touch those water tubs. And it's muddy and everything else, but they'll drink that first.
That's I guess it's just an innate thing, that, you know, that's what they
well, you know, I think that with those mud puddles like that, there's a lot of mineral nutrients that wash in.
Yes, sir.
I mean, that's...
Yes, sir.
That's just my theory. I'm definitely no biologist or scientist.
I've got a feeling you're exactly right. That it, when we were on your property, there was an area, too, that you showed me with kind of a mineral outcropping. It's a natural. And those deer were coming in. I mean, everything on your property seemed to come into that area.
Come to that area, and they just eat the dirt.
Right.
I mean, just eat dirt. I don't know what kind of mineral they're of. Never done any kind of soil sample on it to see what might pop up, but there's something in that, and it's a spot that's 10, 15 foot across, circle.
Yes, sir.
And I don't know what's there, but
whatever it is, they like it.
They like it.
Evidently, and deer and antelope particularly, but deer like the mule deer and whitetail there, they have an innate ability to determine what they need and what's good for them. And so whatever is there, whether it's a trace mineral, whether it's a salt and trace mineral combination or something else we don't even know about, it was amazing, the tracks. And you could actually see where they had scooped it up with, you know, with kind of licked the ground kind of thing.
I had biologists out here in New Mexico, state biologists, when we first moved out here, I was asking about putting out some blocks and stuff for the antelope. And no, they won't eat them. Well, I put them out anyway. And I tell you what, when they get through eating the sulfur blocks with salt in them, they'll dig a hole 2 or 3 foot deep, eating the soil that's under there where it has melted.
Yeah, it's the
leached into the soil. And they told me, no, they won't do that. Well, I beg to differ. I know they will do it.
And I know they will, too. But for years and years, they were saying, oh, no. And putting out any of that stuff's not going to help anything. Well, it does.
Yeah, and ranch in Texas, we put out a 200-pound protein block during the winter for goats and sheep that we have. And I've seen mule deer just camp out and lay down right there beside them. And
absolutely, yes,
they'll eat them, and they'll go lay down over and get up in a little while, eat some more. Whitetail, not so much. They do eat it, but we keep salt mineral out, a mineral and mixing salt.
Right, yes, sir.
Mix a 50-50 ratio, but I use diatomaceous earth in it to worm the sheep and the goats, and the deer eat the fool out of it.
And I bet it does the exact same thing.
It does. It's got to.
Because I know that deer that Luke Clayton shot when we were there, which was a nice mule deer, but I mean, he was absolutely in great shape, and I love to dig through
and
the guts and
inches of fat,
you know, and check for parasites and all those kind of things. That deer, there was not a sign of any kind of internal parasites and no external parasites.
No, and he had an inch or better back fat on
it. Yes, sir, he did. I mean, it literally had an inch and a half or better on that backside.
Wow.
All across his top and ribs and everything.
Wow. Inside kidney fat just yeah,
you
could
see the kidney. It was just totally closed. Wow. Same thing with the mesenteric fat inside.
Wow.
I mean, so those deer down there are just absolutely in fantastic shape. And we're coming down, Jeremiah and I'll be there We're doing this about the, we mentioned the 9th, it's like the 9th or the 10th of September when we're recording this. We'll be down there about of October, not September. It's October 9th, 10th, or whatever it is. But we'll be down there, I think, like the 12th or 13th or something like that, November.
November, yeah.
And Jeremiah, you're in for a treat, I'm telling you. I've been on lots of ranches all over South Texas, all over the western part of the state in Trans-Pecos, and, of course, all over the world when you get right down to it. But that place that Mr. John has, that's one of my favorite places I've ever been to.
Well,
it's just an ideal layout as far as terrain, as far as habitat, as far as vegetation, as far as the history on that place. I mean, it is. You find fossils all up and down around. There are campgrounds from the ancients that were there from how far back?
I've got points that I've picked up and knife blades, flint knife blades.
Right.
I've had dated 8,000 to 12,000 years old.
Yeah. So it's one of those places, and there's a lot of camps there, and evidently those people of many, many years ago felt the same way as what we do, and I know you love that place, too.
Yeah, I've found literally hundreds of campsites, and I've got 8 or 10 or 12 caves that I've found that
yes,
they
sir.
Used.
It is, I mean, you're going to love it.
Man, I'm going to be walking around looking at the ground the whole time. I mean, no, you've told me a lot about this place. I'm really excited to see it. It sounds like a really beautiful, beautiful ranch. But I'm just more pumped up about all these antelope hunts that you got scheduled for us. Well, how many did you say we had again?
87.
Love it. Love it.
You want to call Dave now? No, I dearly love hunting pronghorn antelope, too, but I don't really see another pronghorn antelope hunt in my near future because I really want to concentrate on some of the mule deer and the whitetail things.
Me too.
And particularly there on Mr. John's place because yeah. We were out there when I was there before. I noticed he was looking. I'd already found some campgrounds while we were driving in. You know, you could see the campfires and all this kind of stuff from years past. And then Mr. John and I got out, and he's looking at flint, and I noticed next thing I'm doing, I forgot everything. It was out beyond about 3 or 4 feet from that ATV that we were in because I was looking at the ground for flint.
I probably will, too. Stuff. I probably will, too.
Well, it's funny. We were riding along in the Ranger, and I saw something shining. I stopped and backed up. He said, "What do you see?" I got up and picked it up. And I said, "I thought it was an arrowhead, but it's not, it's just a chunk of flint." And I threw it down, pulled up about 10 foot. And I said, "But this one's not. This one's an arrowhead."
That's awesome.
And then from then on, he couldn't do nothing but watch the ground for arrowheads.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Over the years, when I used to hunt South Texas down that old brush country, there are a lot of artifacts down in through there as well, too. And I'd be hunting deer, and I'd look down, and all of a sudden I'd find an arrowhead or a broken point, you know, and no telling how many big deer I walked up over the top of, chased out, because I was looking at the ground instead of looking where I was
supposed to. Blew them plumb out of the country.
I'm sure I did, by golly.
But when I'm driving all the time, I'm not looking where I'm going. I'm looking down at the ground, and, you know, just. And I find a lot of them laying alongside the roads
yes,
on the ranch. Just
yes, sir.
Be running along 15, 20 miles an hour, slam on brakes, back up, and pick it up.
Yeah.
I've got tubs full of them.
To me, that is so much fun. I mean, I love to find an arrow point and, you know, try to imagine what the guy was that made it or who he was and, you know, some of his thoughts and all those kind of things.
What he killed with it.
What did he kill with it, you know? Yeah. It's just, and at one time, all that country, there were still some, there were elk in there at one time and there were quite a few black bear and the buffalo range down that far as well, too, from time to time. And so,
well, you know, yesterday we walked up on the Big Cedar Ridge. We didn't find any arrowheads, but you did find some pottery up there.
You bet.
From the Pueblo Indians, the Anasazis.
Yeah, all this New Mexico country that we're in, I've hunted a lot of times. You'll find a little point that runs out over kind of a fairly open area, and a lot of times there'll be pottery or there'll be a campground up there on top. And you wonder, where did the water come from? But like on that, were you talking about, there was a, looked like a little rill or something like that, and I'd be willing to bet at one time there was a spring there, you know, as we've increased the human population and pulled so much water out of the ground, for including for farming, but particularly for human consumption, that water table has dropped considerably over so many areas. And so now these areas that look like they never had any water, there's probably a sink or a spring.
Back in the 30s, Clunch, where we're located, Clunch, New Mexico, in the middle of nowhere, was the pinto bean capital of the world, they say. They called it pinto bean capital.
He told me that. And when we drove up, Jeremiah and I met there at the post office, which is not much of a, but there were some older buildings there that were just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And we were wondering what brought folks to this area right here. And then you mentioned that.
And then what happened?
Yeah.
Because it's all abandoned.
I mean, people still eat pinto beans, or I don't know, we do at our house.
I don't know. I've heard that when they, back in the 30s, when they first started with a nuclear testing program, that they detonated a bomb over at Alamogordo at the White Sands Missile Range, and everything went downhill from there.
That's very likely.
And
because we're not that far from the Mescalero, Apache Reservation where we were last week, kind of thing. But particularly at White Sands, we're not that far
Suppose
away.
Suppose Lane carried a small nuclear bomb that crashed right over here on the Chupadera Mesa, which is
just right there. Yes,
just a mile and a half, 2 miles from us, right here.
Yes, sir.
And some of the old timers around here have told me about it, which there's not very many of them left there.
What are you telling me, John? Am I about to grow a tail?
Possibly.
Or
That's why I told you don't drink the water out here.
Or a third eyeball.
Not to drink the water. That's exactly right, John. He said, y'all, the water here is good to take a bath in and, you know, wash dishes in, but I don't think you want to drink it while you're here.
But it's kind of bitter. Have you tasted it?
No, I have not tasted it.
I've rinsed my mouth out with it. It's bitter.
It's so much calcium in it.
Yes,
it's
sir.
Unbelievable. It plugs up the water lines to the... If you got a water valve where you can turn your water off going to any of our water tanks, we've got valves all over to shut it down if we need to repair it. And those valves get clogged up, and then you got to go down 4 foot deep and dig a big hole out to get down in there and cut that valve out, and it's literally calcified, and it's hard as a rock.
Wow.
But, it's not good drinking water.
No.
Not real good bathing water.
Well, I noticed it was a little tough to get any kind of soap action going there.
That's why I use the liquid soap, because you can wear a bar of soap out in about 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
And still not getting
and
lather.
Still not getting lather. But that's one of the few negative things, even if you call that a negative thing.
I won't call it a negative.
It's not a negative to me either.
Man, it's so dusty out here. Every day we came in and our necks, our faces were just covered with dust. And I scooped out a half an acre of dirt out of my ear, you know, today.
Doesn't take long to get that way either.
No.
No. Today, of course, the wind's been whipping like crazy. We got a little cold front coming in, and the wind out of the south is just being pulled up that way. And I assume tomorrow morning we get up, and when Jeremiah and I've got to leave to go on to another hunt, we're probably having the same kind of thing, but from the north this time.
Yeah, it's supposed to cool down some, and it's actually warmer this year than what it normally is. Normally, we're down in 30s and having frost every morning. We get ready to go. And
That's kind of nice, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I love that cold weather kind of situation like that. Well, gentlemen, it has been an absolute pleasure. I look forward to starting our campfire up with this conversation again in about a month down at close to Iran. And, Mr. John, thank you so very much for your contribution to the DSC Foundation.
And it was my brother
hosting the hunt and hosting us.
It was my brother Jeff's and I's pleasure to be able to help out.
Well, next time we get together down there, we'll bring Mr. Jeff in on a little bit of a conversation as well, too.
We'll do that.
He's quite a character as well. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all so very much for being with us. If you'd like to learn a little bit more about DSC, you can go to www.biggame.org. If you want to learn more about the DSC Foundation, you can go to that website, or you can go to dscf.org as well, too. And Mr. John, I know you do some hunts for mule deer and whitetail, particularly farther south, and occasionally you have some permits left here from that are not already spoken for. How does somebody get in touch with you if they want to try to book a hunt for themselves or a family member, or, you know, maybe two or three buddies coming together on a hunt?
My email address is jweason, that's EASON, the number 3 @hotmail.com. Or my cell phone number is area code 863-781-1254.
That phone number one more time?
Area code 863-781-1254.
I can promise you this, if you book a hunt with Mr. Eason or through the Eason family, you're going to have an absolutely fantastic time and great, great people, fabulous country, and just can't say enough good things about these guys or their hunting operations. So we'll try to reconvene this particular group here in about a month, and in the meantime, y'all have an absolutely great time. We're into the fall hunting seasons now. Let us know how you're doing. You can always get in touch with me at Larry Wysoon Outdoors on Instagram, or Larry Wysoon Outdoors Facebook page as well, too, and send us a photograph or two of what you've taken, and, you know, let us know what you're looking for. We'll do our best to accommodate, to tell you a story, and try to tell you, even maybe tell you the truth every once in a while. So y'all join us right back here for DSC's Campfires next week.
To leave a comment or suggestion for an upcoming episode, go to Instagram at Larry Wysoon Outdoors. Please join me right here next week for another DSC's Campfires.
DSC Campfires with Larry Wysoon has also been brought to you by the Texas Wildlife Association, working for tomorrow's wildlife today. TRHP Outdoors, Kenetrek Boots for the trails less traveled, Boyt, the finest in hunting gear, Pyramid Air for all things air gun, and Ripcord, rescue travel protection.